as we know, a lot of the images that were coming out in the 19th century couldn't be printed in newspapers and so on. Whether it comes to, let's say, Samuel Bourne or Ahmad Ali Khan, and it comes to Hooper. Now, there are three different kinds of photographers who have three different kinds of reception. Would your argument change based on this level of circulation of who saw it at that time or who gets access to it as a result even today?
Certainly changes, for example, how we read this putatively democratic tenor of photography. Ahmad Ali Khan's photographs were initially circulated among a very select group. And so as a result, of course, it becomes a luxury product, photography, just like painting, in fact. The chapter on sympathy is focused on the renderings of photographs into drawings so that they could be published in newspaper accounts. There's something like the indexical at work already, even in the drawing. At the same time, however, insofar as all of these images survive, the history itself ensures that they circulate differently. I shuttle between, as I find myself doing all the time, between making a historicist claim based on the specificity of a particular time and place and a particular form of reception, and making a claim that because of it being a photograph, that initial historicist claim has to be conditioned, has to be modulated.
How did you decide the timeline, let's say, for your publication?
I had an arbitrary cutoff. That's a nice thing about historicism, that you can be arbitrary. The title makes it clear that I'm looking back at these images, although a lot of those images were produced at the height of empire. They're not residues of empire, they are it. And yet, I want to be absolutely clear that the reader knows that these are after images that I am interpreting. The Sepoy Revolt was clearly going to be central because it was such a seismic event and it changed completely how India was governed. So a lot of the book, I think two of the chapters are about that event. And I think the remaining two chapters are really about the sort of after effects of that event, both the chapter on the picturesque and also the chapter on sympathy. How one lives in the aftermath of extreme violence and what happens during extreme violence. My next book is about impunity, which is about what are the conditions under which people get away with murder.
Any study, let's say a study such as yours of a kind of historical moment also sort of allows it to diffract in so many ways. It's almost, as one of the critics has called it, it's polysemic. It's sort of entering the field from all directions and then changing maybe the nature of how we perceive that image. What were some of the images that really struck you while you were making, or thinking about the book?
I think the images from the famine still haunting me because I realized only after the book was done that there's a whole genealogy of liberalism and liberal rationality that I don't engage with. Other images, Samuel Bourne has this image. It's a picturesque image of a figure in a landscape, but it strikes me as extremely forlorn. And that interested me about these colonial officers who did all kinds of terrible things in India. And, they were sort of hovering over this abyss of a kind of a wasted life and sort of trying to claw their way to the top of a social hierarchy by being colonial officers.
One of the things that you've mentioned, that the image itself is a kind of transnational object anyway. And certainly because it's the empire, the transnationality becomes part of a plethora of images that is developed in and around empire. While researching this publication, were you looking at other regions in South Asia?
Yeah, actually, originally the book was going to be about Egypt and India, and so it was going to be very comparative. But then for various practical reasons, including the fact that I had 3 years of Arabic and it was still not enough to read the 19th century sources, I decided to leave Egypt out. My hope was that the book's arguments would be relevant to other contexts, some of which I uncover in the book when I track a photographer's travels.
The after image is something I want to think about right now. It's such a loaded word because it talks about something that may become obsolete. It's something that leaves a trace and a residue, obviously. But it's also the aftermath. It's the ending and then the recap, the memorialization almost. And this is also something that you talk about to an extent. But can you just unpack that word for us a little bit?
Is the aftermath. It's funny, that word after image was the word I was really wedded to. I wouldn't let the publisher change that one word. And it's because the after image also, through the Frankfurt School Marxist tradition, particularly in Benjamin, the after image is also a moment of a possible reactivation of a former hope, historical hope, or a historical catastrophe. And it's that ambiguity of the afterimage that it's both trace and residue, and at the same time is a kind of potential danger or a possible hope. That, to me, encapsulated what these images are doing, because they're from the 19th century. They're about one particular organization of capitalism at a particular place and time. And yet, there were so many correspondences one could see between, for example, the account that one of the generals gave of making Brahmins clean up the blood of other Indians, etc., and defiling them religiously. Around the time that I was writing the book and reading those accounts and looking at some of the images from those accounts, you know, the Americans were using religious humiliation to humiliate prisoners in Iraq and the Abu Ghraib scandal. So that's the kind of danger that the afterimage also poses, that these forms of these histories repeat, but not identically. I can't remember the name, said that history rhymes, that it doesn't repeat. So it's that potential to rhyme for good and bad that I feel like that notion of the afterimage opens up. I feel like history is absolutely critical to that book, to my arguments in it. Without doing the historical work, I couldn't have done that book. But I didn't want either those images or the investments that those photographers had in their practices to be reducible just to that historicist narrative. I wanted those images to continue to speak to us. And that requires doing some violence to historicism, but not to history, I think.
It's also, to an extent, what one thinks about when one thinks about affect theory, which in the last decade has certainly come to the forefront of many, many debates.
Yeah. That question gets to the heart of so many of my disagreements within the field of photography. Insofar as affect theory has a kind of Deleuzian lineage, and a lot of affect theorists, I find, they make affect the solution to problems rather than a starting point. So I have found some of that work not helpful. But I'm absolutely fascinated by affect. The chapter on sympathy is about that. It's about how sympathy misfires. It's about how when you're feeling most sympathetic is when you're possibly wanting to simply replicate what you already know. Where Azoulay is concerned, there was a moment where I was really trying to engage the work around civil contract of photography, which I think is fascinating and helpful. My frustration with it is that the language of contract assumes a rational subject who can then enter into a contract. And my other problem with it is that there's no authority, no supra-juridical authority that can guarantee the contract. So there's neither an unconscious, because we have rational subjects, and there's actually historically has not been, I don't see how it would be, an authority that could ratify the sort of ethical impulse we feel when we look at images of suffering. It was the ambiguities that intrigued me. It was the part where someone who is completely acting irrationally will never enter into any civil contract, but will then also potentially produce an image, Samuel Bourne I'm thinking of, that can be read against the grain of the narratives he would have us read in them. Not to say that Azoulay's account doesn't leave room for that, she does. If Azoulay's account is a little too algebraic, if you will, affect theory is a kind of free-for-all, where we are to be celebrated because affect somehow lives outside of subjects, which is a completely incoherent idea to me. But on the other hand, the book does go into one of the great grandfathers of affect theory, Spinoza, because for him, affect is a question about ethics. And that I found really productive, to go directly to some of the sources that affect theory cites.
Once you've looked at the material from the subcontinent, and there are comparative histories to be told and so on and so forth, how much of this discourse in and around South Asia really resonates within the departments of South Asia to an extent?
I think some of the contemporary photography is something people are really starting to engage with now. At Princeton, at least, our South Asia program is very small. Princeton did not participate in that program to build a South Asia collection in the library. On my campus, at least, just to have a nascent South Asia program, which largely right now is focused on anthropology and history, that's better than nothing. But I think with respect to visual culture and photography, I think a lot of really great work continues to happen in anthropology departments. And it seems to me some of the work that people are most engaged with are photography as art, photography as high art. There seems to be a focus away from the everyday nature of photography. Kadri Jain has done some fantastic work on that, which is photography as a kind of visual practice. But I'm seeing more and more essays coming out about Indian photographers who are showing in museums, etc. So there's a lot more interest in that too.
What has the reception, according to you, of this book been like? Just your sense of the reactions to the book.
The reactions have been surprising. An author always has to, at some point, imagine an audience. Otherwise, how else would you write? But I imagine that my audience would be someone like me who does interdisciplinary work, is familiar with a handful of critical traditions, but is not wedded directly to any of them. That's what I thought would be my audience, largely someone informed by cultural studies. Interestingly, the book is being read more in art history than in English departments. And that's interesting to me. And so far, the reception has been mixed. I think some very traditional historians find that it's very theoretical, gets into these rabbit holes around semiotics and around, you know, questions of signification or interpretation. And I'm finding graduate students like it much more than faculty do. And in my mind, I think that's a sign of success. But the people who are sort of around my age find it to be quite an oddball book. But some part of me kind of likes being a contrarian.